our program this afternoon is going to be very informal. We're going to talk about our experiences in living in campaign in Atlanta, our observations, our personal thoughts, our disappointments, and our frustrations. We hope that you enjoy what we're about to say. This is not a practice program. It's just going to be free from our thoughts and our hearts. So we will start with Irma Bridgewater, because she has lived in Urbana all of her 70 years. I hope she doesn't mind me saying her name, but I'm going to tell mine too. I think we should be very proud of our inheritance and our ability to make progress through the years. I'm sure Irma has made definite progress from her beginning years. I know she has. She's contributed an awful lot to the community, and we're real proud of her ability and her accomplishments. So I'd like to start with her, Mrs. Bridgewater.
Yeah, well, you see, I'm not 70 yet.
Oh, you're 70.
I will be in November.
Oh, 69 then.
As she says, I was born here. And my father was also born here. And I regret now that I didn't talk to him more about what happened in the years he was growing up. The only thing I know for sure is that he went to the same school that I did. At that time, 1913, of course, we were born in our houses. None of us, very few, well, I don't think any of us were born in hospitals. And the majority of blacks lived north of Washington Street. We were bounded by the tracks. So we lived north of the Big Four tracks and east of Illinois Central. There were, however, some pockets, what I call pockets, or smaller neighborhoods, like Maple Street, and there were a few who lived on Walnut Street and Hickory Street. My parents moved to Ells Avenue in an area where it too was integrated like this was up here, with us poor folks, poor whites and poor blacks. And there were only three people on the street that we moved to on Ells Avenue, three black families, and one on Charles. And another woman attempted to move in on Charles Street, and the Ku Klux Klan, believe it or not, was in operation at that time here in Champaign. And they had decided that she wasn't going to move there. They burned the cross at the house. But the men of the community, both ends of the community, got together and they had guns. Well, we had some nice people around who would let us know what, you know, was going on. And they got together and got up on the railroad tracks. And I remember it because we had to stay inside. Parents had kept us in. And they were on the railroad tracks with guns, and they were going to do something, but nothing happened. They didn't do it. I guess they got news of what was coming up. People who came here, this was a pretty good dropping off place, I guess, for people on their way to Chicago, and also people who came through, men especially, who came through working on the railroad, and they stopped and stayed. Champaign seemed to be a pretty good place to stop off and stay. Then there were other people who came to work at the university. It was a good place for women, especially. My grandmother brought my mother and her sister here for that reason. They came to work on. She came to work at the campus. It was hard work because the pots and pans and kettles that they moved around and used. It was also hard because they had it all to do, because in later years they had special cooks for different things. They had to get up early in the morning, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, to be sure they got there to get the breakfast ready. It was, then there were also some where the husband and wife both work on campus at fraternities. And the husbands, of course, were the quarters. Then we got some of the goodies sometime. Socially, the young children, as we were growing up, played their biggest fun, I guess, most fun, was at birthday parties. We had, you put on your little polka dot dress and went to a birthday party with a gift under your arm. There were also special occasions, parties with Halloween parties and so on. And we played games like spin the bottle and post office. tell my grandson today about playing post office. He said, "Really, you played post office? What was that?" I told him about the little boys and went into his room and went and kissed them. It was fun. The parties were in homes, and I guess at that time, parents were a little more patient, I suppose, with us as children than we are today, because all the parties were in homes. As we got older, in teens, the parties were still in the homes. And we danced then. We were able to, most everybody had a piano. And if you're given a party, you made sure that you invited somebody like this. And you'd be sure you could call off and play. I had one or two that I played, so when I got my little playing done, I could get up and dance, and somebody else had theirs. So you made sure, but there were some awful nice parties. They were nice. And they usually served probably ice cream and cake or something like that. The churches were another part of our social life to quite an extent. For instance, one of the churches, well, in teenage, Bethel had church Sunday school in the afternoon at 3 o'clock. So you went to Sunday school in the afternoon, then you went to the Baptist church or BYPU, and then the boys were already out there. And then we went to Sanctified Church in the evening. When the movies started, having movies in the afternoon on Sunday, and that stopped the Sunday school, at least the attendance wasn't quite as good. Now, when we went to the movies in the Park Theater, we sat in the two front rows right under the screen. At the Orpheum, we sat two or three rows at the back. Virginia was upstairs in the balcony, the back rows. We gradually moved down. The usher would take us up there, and you know, you get lost on his way up, you get lost down closer. You know, he went on and you stayed there. With the adults, the amusement was with the lodges, the Masonic Lodge especially. They had dances, well, we call them balls, really, because they were real. It was something really to look forward to. I remember my dad used to be on some of the committees for decoration, and one time they decided to have a snow scene, and we tied little pieces of cotton on strings of, for a whole great big hall. But it was pretty, and they had pretty lights along with it. And also there were dances, big dances with large bands that were a band would become a troupe, and we had dances in the churches for adults and children were family picnics that we had at Homer Park. They had the church also had a playground on Ells Avenue across from our house where they played to play tennis, baseball. And they could ride the streetcar down to John Street and then walk the rest of the way down to the house. As far as the schools were concerned, we attended neighborhood schools. Lawhead here, there were about four of us at Lincoln School at the time I was there. Gregory School, and that's about it. the high school, the grade schools went 1 through 7. The 8th grade was what we call Central School, it was downtown. We went to senior high at Edison. They had a swimming pool there, and we weren't in the swimming program or allowed in the pool until Mr. Edwards, my father, and a few other parents decided that we should be allowed to swim. And what they ended up with was a swimming class after school, after everybody else had finished. Well, of course, they were criticized, parents were criticized for that. But it was a beginning. And I ran into that too, that same kind of thing later, when some of us decided we'd like our daughters to take ballet lessons. And Joanne had the class after she had finished the other class. And, you know, I guess it'd be a drag after a while. You got to stay there later and go along with these other kids. So she finally integrated it into the rest of it, which, and we were criticized for that too. But we had to start someplace. And the same way with Mr. Phillips, when he started this area up here, Carver Park, he was criticized too for taking all the people up here. But it works out finally. One of the things I remember about grade school and high school especially was studying about the Civil War and slavery, and how I felt, and I still get upset when I think about it now, how I felt when we talked about slavery and felt like 2 cents. And today I wouldn't feel that way. The other day I went to Washington School and I saw Martin Luther King and a whole board full of black is. And black was all wonderful things. Where to me, when I was in grade school, it wasn't like that, or in high school. And maybe that was my parents' fault or mine, or anyhow, I didn't know. That was one of, to me, that was one of the advantages of having people who were born in the South, because they got to know more about their heritage than I did, or you did, this way. One of the other things that happened in high school too was the counselors were doing then what some of them I guess are still doing. They discouraged us from taking college preparatory courses. When I went home with that news, my parents said that I was going to go to college, so I took it. But there were others who had to go into other schools, because they weren't encouraged to go ahead and take these college preparatory courses. The jobs, the kind of work done was, as I stated, was at the university primarily. And with waiters, worked at country clubs, service in homes, husbands and wives would live in some of the homes and work there cooking and taking care of. The students at the university worked on campus too, in fraternities and sororities for meals, working for their meals. We had a very good relationship between the students and the community at that time. Well, I guess for one reason, there was no place else for them to stay, so we lived in housing. There were a lot of people who kept students. They were a part of the church. They were a part of social life. They were a part of the full, they were fully a part of the community. For business at that time, we had the business area was between the railroad tracks, always a railroad track there, from the railroad tracks east to First Street, right there by the station. And there we had a restaurant, tavern, we had a taxi cab company, with a pool room there. Downtown, or on the other side of the tracks, the Main Street, Cliff Jordan, had a barber shop, and it was real nice barber shop, and he lived above. But the barber shop was for whites. And I went to Johnson Publishing Company with a group, and as we got off the elevator, Mr. Johnson was standing there, so he asked us where we were from. And I said, I'm from Champaign. He started talking about the time he went to a barber shop in Champaign and couldn't get a haircut, into a black barber shop, couldn't get a haircut. Another business we had on Main Street was Alan Green's cleaning establishment. And Mr. Chavis, which is now Royal Cleaners, was out on Green Street. And I guess that's about it. That gets us up to about, me up to about 1933. We survived the flu epidemic and the depression, which was just made things a little bit worse than what we already had.
Thank you. This is Bridgewater. I came here in 1932. I married a doll that was born and raised in Champaign. I found that things weren't much different than what Mrs. Bridgewater has explained to us. Housing was really, of course, was during the depression. Housing was still a problem. The students didn't have money, but they wanted an education. They came here with no money, but the community made them welcome in their homes, and the churches also. The churches have always been a very important part of Champaign-Urbana, and I always thought if you are a stranger in a town, go to some church and meet people there and go on from there. This is what I did. I went to Salem Church for a few Sundays, and then I went to Bethel. And the people made me so welcome. I stayed. And I enjoyed the church. And this was most of our activity was the activities that were through the churches. There were lots of social affairs, of course, and formals, and there were clubs. But housing was still very difficult. If you were able to purchase a house in a new area, which a new area would be called an area where Negroes had never lived, I know two instances where a white person bought the house for these people and then sold it back to them. Sold it to the Negro. This is how they were able to purchase a house that they wanted and could afford. And in fact, one family is still there. And but this was very frustrating too, to know that your job, you were qualified, but you couldn't buy where you could afford to live. My husband and I had the experience also of we saved enough money to buy an $1,800 house. Now, at that time, you think that that's not any money, but $1,800 during 1932 and 33 was an awful lot of money. We had to have, before the man said he would let us have it for $400 down. We went to the loan company and with our $400, and they still wouldn't loan us the money, even though we had money for the down payment. We went to banks, and the banks were because of where we wanted to buy. Now, this is hard to believe now, because I'm in real estate now, and if you have the money, of course, you can buy any place you want to buy, whether you want it or not. This has been one of the frustrations that I think we've been able to overcome. Jobs are, I feel now that if you're qualified, you can get just about any job that you want. Sometimes you have to go around about, but not all the time. I also observe that our children are getting a better education, and they are more ambitious. They say that we're still an illiterate group, but I don't feel that way. If we are, is because of the schools aren't giving us the attention that we should get. Of course, I don't have an education, but I've lived with a lot of people who've had a very fine education, so I know what's being done. I've kept students for many years because they couldn't live on campus. They had to come out in the community and find a place to live. And my finest students that I kept, the first students that I kept were two little boys that came to my door one night. We were eating dinner. And they said, "Lady, we're here in Champaign going to school, and we don't have any place to live." So the lady let us stay with her for two nights, but we have to move. And we let the little boys in. They were 17 years old, and they shared our supper, and they moved in with us, and they stayed 5 years. They stayed here and got their master's degree, and they're both very fine, one's a lawyer and one's a doctor. But if, you know, when you think of the experiences you have like that, set it out. They were determined, which is a wonderful thing. They had patience that we don't have now. But, well, I mean, a lot of us don't have the patience that it took for the people who came before us. Some of the things that are being done now, it took patience and courage and a special commitment for them to do what they did so we'd be able to live like we're living now, and the younger generation are able to live like they're living now. Housing and jobs and living conditions were very, very bad. But when I think of how long it took us to save $400, and then we went to the banks and the building loans, and nobody would accept. So the man finally sold us this little $1,800 house for our convent. And we had to do a lot of work on it, but it was our home. But this is the way we've had to do. Nobody, there was, I think, I don't think anybody feel hurt, but there was a Negro couple, Gus and Maddie Dixon, who worked in a private home, and they were able to build a brand new house out on Maple, and it was modern, and it cost $400. Now, Mr. Dixon told me that But see, $400 back, way back then, was, you could get them, they had a lovely home. In fact, we thought, when I came here, I thought it was one of the nicest homes around. They kept it well. And, but as I say, I don't want to talk too long. And I must say this, we've had a dream and we have come a long way. But the dream isn't over. We have to keep dreaming and working and an education. I think the more we learn, we have to learn. All we can learn. If we have to go to school all of our lives, and this is a mistake I've made, but I try to encourage any young person, go to school, even if you have to eat bread and water. In the end, it'll pay off, because we do need to learn. We've just been so far back, we've lost so much of our heritage because we weren't thinking, we weren't taught to think. Our heritage has been buried. We can never dig it up. It has gone down with our relatives and friends. So we have to start doing something now, so the next generations to come will know what has gone on before them. Mrs. Clarksdale was talking to us about the Negro education in Champaign Urbana.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Gray. Mrs. Gray asked me, a relative newcomer to Champaign Urbana, came here in 1971, to participate on this program, and she told me the nature of the program. I indeed feel much like an outsider, because I have not lived in Champaign as long as she and Mrs. Bridgewater and many of you have. I have lived in America 60 years and 2 months. And that's telling you age. I've been black all the time. And I've been poor all that time. And as I hear you, I've heard these ladies talk about Champaign, Urbana, and how some of my relatives on the way up the IC ride number 3 to Chicago from Mississippi must have thought they were in heaven and maybe they were ready for the bubbly. Decided when they heard the word Champaign, this must be it. Maybe that's why some of them got off. But I grew up in Mississippi where things were not supposed to be as good as they were supposed to be in Champaign, Urbana at the time the ladies have spoken of. It sounds very much like I'd have been pretty much at home in Champaign, Urbana. I'm not going to tell you about those kinds of experiences, just they were going on, except they were supposed to. No one took for granted that we could do anything except on Saturday when my mother would take all 5 of us to notorious Philadelphia, Mississippi, which was 14 miles from our farm, to get an ice cream cone. She could go in and buy, and we'd stand up in the hot Mississippi sun and try to beat it. You could get a double, a great big ice cream cone for a dime. And double dip, they call them, in all kinds of multi colors. And we'd stand there in stair steps, I being the oldest, going right down to my sister, the youngest, and try to out-lick the sun, as it were, to beat the ice cream from going all over us. That was the way it was. Doesn't sound too much like it was, in many ways, too different here. So it was in all of America. Because I am a newcomer and I don't know this history, and because Catherine Humphreys was supposed to have done this speech in the first place, she does know more of history. And because I like to talk and I know too much about being black in America to ever get through, I got up this morning and typed my little speech out. So if I mispronounce something, it could well be because my typing is for the birds. But I'm going to read mine so I'll get done. And then if there are things you want to talk about, I'll do that. When Mrs. Gray asked me to talk about the last few years in Champaign, Urbana schools, it wasn't really too difficult to think of a few things that would perhaps be relevant to this occasion. So I do appreciate the opportunity, Mrs. Gray, of being able to sit in front of Catherine. Educational changes in Champaign, Urbana over the past 20 years at least have reflected the changes in race relations in America over the same period of time. Although physically located outside my South, the economic conditions, housing patterns, social structures, and institutional as well as personal attitudes toward blacks were quite similar, we've just heard, in Champaign, Urbana. to what was seen and practiced in Jackson, Mississippi, Anniston, Alabama, or Savannah, Georgia, or wherever we might have been that we could call the South. In 1960, conditions for blacks as a group were not very good any place in America. There were forces at work in the South which would eventually spill over to the regions outside the South, would result in changes everywhere. Mrs. Bridgewater alluded to those, Martin King's group. They were beginners of much of the marching that we were seeing in the South, all over the South at the beginnings, and finally, of course, all over the country. Surely some of these changes would impact on blacks in Champaign-Urbana schools, as well as all other areas of life. Last week, the student newspaper at the University of Illinois, the Daily Illini, printed an article called Back of the Bus, in which writer Donna St. George attempted to chronicle school-related problems in Champaign-Urbana from the mid-60s to the present. I'd like to read a little excerpt from this rather lengthy article, and I would recommend it to those of you who are historians of the town to see whether or not she was very accurate in her accounting. In 1966, and I am reading from St. George's article now, the Champaign Unit 4 School District responded to the local movement for desegregation by appointing a group of local leaders and educators to study the issue. The group was called the Equal Education Opportunities Committee. The movement's decisive spark came when Urbana desegregated its school system in 1967, one of the first to do so in the state. The black community gave its final push. A march was staged that drew a following of 300 to 400 people. Emotions ran high. Equality was the theme. We wanted black for white, recalls Ken Stratton, who now is, as you well know, an outstanding leader in our community and a participant in Champaign Public Schools. We wanted superintendent for superintendent, cook for cook, teacher for teacher, janitor for janitor. We wanted equality, so Mr. Stratton is quoting. The community got what black leaders wanted. The decision to desegregate the schools came in the spring of 1967 after extended research and a study of the Evanston School District 65, the first in the state to be desegregated. Some had come in to committee meetings, said Rupert Evans, who was a member of the committee and is now a retired professor at the University of Illinois, with the idea that neighborhood schools were God's gift. Gradually, people realized this tended to penalize students in schools where there was a plurality of one race and social class. The board's Equal Educational Opportunities Committee agreed on three needed components in Champaign's desegregation plan. It had to include a combination of redrawn districts, new magnet special program schools, and for the first time, mandatory student busing. The program was a sweeping departure from a segregated past. The board provided the community a year's transition period to adjust to the plan. Workshops and meetings for community parents and teachers helped air concerns. In 1968, the first desegregation plan in the city of Champaign was enacted 5 days from the 5 years, I'm sorry, before the state mandate. The community's responses were mixed. Some people didn't want it at all. Vern Barksdall, our own executive director of the Urban League in Champaign County, said. Others, he's quoted as having said, accepted it as an idea whose time had come. The black community accepted it wholly. What was going on, as is written in those lines, was what was going on wherever we were, wherever black people were in the South and indeed outside the South in the mid-60s. 17 years after 1966, Champaign schools are still in turmoil. Although some efforts have been made to redistribute the student population more equally, despite redistricting and the busing of some white children to achieve desegregation, problems prevail. You read about it. The papers are full of it. I don't know how truthful it is, but it's printed. Lately, it seems there's something almost dated. Perhaps with some minor differences in management of its problems, the same kinds of socio-political maneuverings have prevailed in Urbana from the mid-60s to the present. Your guess about when they will stop in Urbana or in Champaign, as well as in any city where institutionalized racism is rampant, is just as good as mine. Yet we must admit that some changes have been made. The ladies before me have certainly alluded to how it's true. The fact that I don't cook at the University of Illinois is true. The fact that many of you who do whatever you do, wherever you do it in Champaign, Urbana, besides cook and clean up, is evidence that it is true. These changes didn't all come about in the 60s. Some of them had certainly begun long before then. We certainly have seen some rather significant changes since then. To get some idea about the most significant changes in Champaign-Urbana schools over the past 15 to 20 years, a period I was asked to try to address, I asked two well-informed veterans of the educational scene for some information from their perspectives. These two outstanding black citizens, Mr. Kenneth Stratton, Director of Pupil Personnel Services in the Champaign School, and Evelyn Underwood, involved parent and baptized in the fire, longtime board member of Urbana Schools, graciously responded to my request. And I'd like to share just some brief excerpts from those, and I don't intend to read any real long papers to you later. I asked these people to give me just a brief statement for this day about what some in their views the significant changes are or have been that they have seen take place since 1960 in Champaign and Urbana. Each spoke for his or her own city briefly. What forces helped to bring these changes about, positive and negative effects on black students as they had seen them, and how well black students are being educated today, as well as any changes they feel should be made in the near future and the next 10 years. And I asked them for brief responses, and being very intelligent people, they obeyed. In fact, Mr. Stratton, in an effort to respond to my first question about the most significant change, felt integration of schools in September 1968 was indeed it. Mrs. Underwood elaborated a little more, desegregation, and then of course she talks about some other changes, individualized instruction, Titles I and VII programs, heterogeneous grouping, special education programs, Hayes School being renamed for Dr. King, black staff employment, etc. With regard to forces which have helped bring the changes about, community pressure is more or less thought to have been the main force by both respondents. Positive effects that the changes that we've seen have had on our children, more students graduating from Urbana High School, higher retention rate, positive role models, and that is especially important. I believe Mrs. Gray alluded to the role of role models, and having grown up where I did, I would love to have some time to talk to you about some of the role models in my most deprived life, as you would have thought of a little poor farm child. But whatever it was that we knew about that was good, we couldn't see what the white folk were doing, and we saw it with the black folk. And boy, when my mama got through telling me about how important it was to be proud and to do whatever it was the Sunday school teacher said do, school teacher, I was 8th grade before I had a high school, had a teacher who graduated from high school, but he knew how to teach, same man, and it was a good time, I guess, to have been alive as I look back, but the role models are important, and I'm glad that, and I know you are, to see some for us, so yeah, Evelyn thinks that's important, I think it's important. Mr. Stratton thinks that social relations between black and white students have certainly improved positively, I doubt any of us disagree. Black students have a greater access to resources of the district. Students with special needs are more readily responded to. And then there are some administrative changes. Special education, special classes have been alluded to in both instances. With regard to negative effects, and there are always some of those, I guess. Black students are in a greater percentage bused and for longer distances in Champaign schools, so I'm told here. poor families are somewhat isolated still from the environment of their children's schools, and all of us could really write a little speech on any of these ourselves from our own experiences. In Urbana, somewhat similar problems are alluded to, and certainly because of the nature of her own experiences on our board of education in District 116, the comment is made, there has been some retrenchments of the board and the administration of, from the 60s to the present, and I'm going to talk about that sort of thing a little bit more in a moment. How well are black students being educated today? That's, Mr. Stratton says, this question begs a dissertation, and that's true. In fact, anything like we are all talking about begs a dissertation. Simplified, however, he says, black students are being educated just as poorly or just as well as white students. However, the quality of education is more important to black students because their needs are so much more acute. They were so much more behind the distance that Mrs. Gray alluded to earlier. And Mrs. Underwood is mindful of what we're still seeing too much of, and this certainly is not peculiar to Urbana or to Champaign either for that matter, that many of our children are in dead-end classes, tested into special education, etc. Then finally we were asking them, what changes do you feel should be made in the future? And again, they're the sorts of things mentioned briefly here. One comment is that some experts think we should go back to all black schools. Certainly not a view held by the person who has written this, Mrs. Underwood. She thinks that that's going backwards, and I certainly would agree with her. I'd like to see us have good schools for all of us together. Then there's a mention of the importance of getting more black people involved in administrative roles, church and community involvement in the education of our children. Somewhat similar comments from the gentleman in Springfield. He says that in the near future, more black people absolutely must become involved in the total educational process. There should be demands for greater participation in policy making, especially at the higher levels. Focus must be on personnel as opposed to curriculum, as the real curriculum is not what is written, but the response of each individual teacher. Black people cannot afford to wait in 10 years for any changes. I've taken the liberty to read these and call the names of my friends who responded. I do appreciate so much their input. You and I could add our own responses and make a very, very long list. Indeed, much on my list would be positive, and I'm sure on your list there would be many positives. We could all elongate our negatives list too. At this point, I'm reminded of a story often credited to the late, great black baseball pitcher Satchel Paige. When asked why he didn't believe in looking back, said, "Something might be gaining on me." You'll forgive me, I'm taking antibiotics, and I'm just dry as a powerhouse. If I keep doing this, I don't know what the medicine's doing, but it's, that would be helpful. I'm almost through, but I'm embarrassed because if you've taken these medicines, you know how it is. I've been fighting for 4 weeks, and I'm having a hard time with it. Like Paige, blacks in Champaign, Urbana, or any other place in America for that matter, can't afford to use too much energy looking back. I'm sure that's what Ken Stratton was talking about when he said we can't afford 10 more years of hoping and seeing. Always something is surely after us. And indeed, if we aren't careful, it's gaining on us. Yet history, which is the past, the looking back, is very important to the future. It's important to the present. It's most definitely important to the future. I wish to just briefly draw a few parallels between what was happening to blacks in America in the decades of 1865 to 1863 and 1965 to 1900. 1983. The similarities are really frightening. And you know, go get your black history and you can fill in all the things. I wish we had time, and I don't even know enough of it to fill in thoroughly, but it's all recorded. It almost seems like we're at the same point in time. There's so many similarities. After the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution in 1865, the Reconstruction Act of 1867, 14th Amendment in 1868, there was a brief. By 1964, we had the Civil Rights Act. In early 1960, blacks, as I said, began the forceful but nonviolent efforts to break segregation's chains. They were indeed binding us on every side. By 1964, we had the Civil Rights Act, in 1965, the Voting Rights Act, and a period of affirmative action with a few more doors being opened. Open to all of us. At least one of us seemed to have been every place. It was during this period we had moved from Durham, North Carolina in 1960 to Atlanta, Georgia. And I was at Ebenezer Baptist Church when Martin King and Ralph Abernathy and people were getting the rallies going and let's get started having things happen. I was teaching at All Black, more or less. They would never say they were ever all black. But I was teaching at Atlanta University. Most blacks thought that was their school. And that's where we were. I remember sending my students' lessons to jail and to the stockades when the jails literally became overrun during the 60s. I was teaching educational psychology classes and my students were all in jail. So instead of going to do a lecture hall kind of thing, I was in the Xerox room in the library room and grinding the stuff out, you know, like a mill, and we would send it down in large carnation milk bottles, boxes for the kids to study. That's the sort of thing we were doing in the South in 61 through 67. So after 65, when there were these parallels of the kinds of acts that were going on in the 100-year period I alluded to earlier, in the decade of 1800 to, well, the two decades really, 1863 to 83 and into the present. So here we are. 65, they say, let there be voting, and you know all that was happening. Johnson and the Great Society was upon us all, wherever. It was affecting us in Champaign, Urbana, it was affecting us in Atlanta, Georgia, wherever we were. And it was during that time that a few doors to that segment of American society, which you and I belong to, were being opened. And at least one of us was sitting by the door, rather near the door. In 1967, the same year that Lester Maddox went down to be the governor of Georgia, I went down to be the first black professor at Georgia State University, a state-owned university, one block down the street from the campus, from the Capitol, right straight down the same street. Georgia State's just right down here. And my friends at Atlanta University just always laughed at me and said, you're the biggest fool I ever saw, Milton Barksdale. Why would you go down there when Lester's got axe handles all over the place? And I said, oh my God, I've dodged those white folks in Mississippi. And by then, you know, I'm young and can run fast. And I wasn't really afraid of all. And Lester Maddox would be right in the line ahead of any of us who were there in the cafeteria line because he came down to eat lunch there too. I never really got here. But I did sit near the door. And I was the first one, and the president was proud. And every time anyone came from the federal government, they'd always march down my end of the hall and say, you know, this is my Dr. Barksdale. And so, you know, we've been there, whatever age we are. Few doors open, but often sitting rather close to that same door. That often meant we not only have got you, but you aren't too much in, and we need to, we can get you out. If you don't believe it, up comes Bakke, affirmative action. You know the Bakke reverse discrimination case, all the publicity about it, as well as I do, and what that had to do with whatever is happening to a similar take back, the same kind of take back that we were running into in the days of Reconstruction. That teamed with a bad economic scene and super take back artist Ronald Reagan will certainly work very hard to see to it that history repeats itself if we aren't careful. And that's what Ken Stratton's talking about, and that's what you're talking about, and what all of us are talking about. in order to prevent then the most vicious type of cycle from going around again. And for the next 100 years, having our great-great-grandchildren see these same sorts of things happen again, we must use most of our energy in creative efforts to move ever forward. Our brief looks back to the past must be to gain insights and strength and courage to outrun those who would psychologically, economically, and morally enslave us again. In many ways, blacks have made progress then in all dimensions in Champaign-Urbana, certainly including the schools. With regard to the schools, then, it behooves us all to see to it that no more ground will be lost and that more gains toward equality of quality education will be made. If we have to do what the great Frederick Douglass said in order to get it done, then go ahead, agitate. Thank you very much.
That was wonderful. I want to thank you, Mrs. Barfield. Mrs. Scott has had a lot of experience in politics. She's very efficient. She has shown herself all over the country and met with all the important people, and she is qualified to meet with any important person in politics in our country or any other country. And for that, I'm very proud. It's very seldom a fine woman will step out and expose herself to the things that Mrs. Scott has exposed herself to get where she is. I don't want to tell you anything about her background because this isn't the time to talk about backgrounds. I'm 69 also. I forgot to tell her. I do want to say that this community is very fortunate in having someone involved in politics like Mrs. Scott has been, and I'm sure there are a lot of things she has done will go down in political history, but now we should put it down in Negro history. So Mrs. Scott, would you please tell us what you think we should know?
Thank you, Mrs. Gray, and I hate being the last one because I wish right now I could turn into a little mouse, run right out the door, put me up against you three dynamic ladies. This has been a lesson for me because never have I heard the history of Champaign-Urbana articulated so succinctly as Mrs. Bridgewater did, with a sequel provided by Mrs. Gray, and I have learned a tremendous amount that I think should be somehow published, Mrs. Williams. You know, I understand this is being recorded. It is always a pleasure to hear Dr. Barksdale because she indeed typifies the role models that I had down south. I'm glad that I can say I was from down south. Someone not too long ago asked me, one of my students, say, are you from Illinois? I said, no, thank God I'm not. Because had I been from Illinois, I probably would have never graduated from high school, Mrs. Williams, because the level of deviance at which I operated is not tolerated in these schools. And so I would not have been sitting here. As a little poem says, perhaps I would have lived far, far away and never would have known anything about Black History Day. So let it be. Mrs. Gray called me, and I wasn't sure, the message that I got was not that I was supposed to confine a discussion of politics to the local arena. So therefore, I went beyond the local, Mrs. Gray. But I think that once I have completed this, which will be rather brief, I can live something about local politics based on my own participation. What I have done is just attempted to profile some outstanding politicians. And the field is so vast, I had to indeed admit at the outset that I was very selective. And rather, the ones that I'm talking about will reflect my particular biases, I might add. Let's begin with Illinois. William Dawson, and all these are Black, by the way. William Dawson, who was born in Georgia, the South, graduated from Fisk University. I think graduated, he was born in 1909, graduated from Fisk University. University, received a law degree in Northwestern, elected to Congress after he organized and ran the powerful all-black second Democratic Ward in Chicago. And some of you from Chicago or have visited Chicago may well know about this powerful group. Somewhere I read said that the late Richard J. Daley was very anxious to support William Dawson's candidacy for Congress in order to move him out because he represented too much of a threat. Just imagine what it would have been like had Dawson really gotten control or kept control of the many blacks that live in Chicago. So he was glad to get rid of Dawson, sent him on to Washington. While Dawson was there, he did was appointed to a standing committee. And I remember nominated the late Lyndon B. Johnson for president in the 1960 election. So William Dawson was a very, very colorful person. Now the next person that I'm going to talk about also is from Illinois, Sherrod Powell, not a protege, because he was too old to be a protege, but was somewhat groomed by William Dawson. And this is the person I address as my father. Many people in Champaign have been know because he's been here many times. And that is Carneal A. Davis, who is yet still alive as a commissioner of the election board in Chicago, served in the state legislature for 36 years. I like to talk about Carneal because the first time I heard about Carneal, I was in grade school. And I didn't tell my age because I am like Jack Benny, I'm 39 and old. But when I was in grade school, being from Fulton, Kentucky, which is just 42 miles across the river from Carroll, Illinois, we were told that some Negro, was popular to say black men, legislator from Illinois, had brought some Negro lawyer down to Cairo, Illinois, to upgrade colored teachers' salaries. Now that's the way I got the message. Well, who was this person? The legislator was Carneal A. Davis, and he transcended this state during the 36 years he served Illinois. He helped all of the people in this state. He did indeed summon the legal help of a brilliant young attorney by the name of Thurgood Marshall. And I'm sure that everybody in this room knows that Thurgood Marshall is the first and only black Supreme Court justice is presently serving. Lyndon B. Johnson, I don't know if you want to call him a Texan Southerner or not, but Lyndon B. Johnson appointed Thurgood, and he appointed him not because he was black, but because he has won more cases before the United States Supreme Court than any other lawyer in the history of American jurisprudence. So I heard about Carneal Davis as he brought this young lawyer down, and they didn't succeed in spite of the fact that white folks came and told them to get on the train, niggas, and go on back where you came from. They did not give up that easily, and they did indeed upgrade salaries of the Negro teachers in Cairo to a level of their white counterparts. Now, I did not have the opportunity to meet the illustrious Carneal A. Davis at that time. I did not meet Carneal Davis until 1961. And how I met him, I must tell, because you're interested in politics. I had applied for a job to do Champaign County Department of Public Aid, having completed a master's degree in education. Well, you know, in any college town, it's difficult to get a job teaching school members because every daughter's daddy's putting his wife or her husband through college, so they're standing in line. So a little white friend of mine suggested that I should go down to the Department of Public Aid, find social work. So I went and checked out a book in the library, read it, went over there and took the test. For some act of God, it had to be God, I scored the highest grade among those taking the test. And find out when the scores came back down, Judge Frederick Green, the illustrious appellate judge in the state of Illinois, came to my house because we were personal friends. I had worked in his home as a maid while I was going to school. And Fred came into my living room that morning at Greenland, West Michigan, sat down on the couch and said, "Well, I came to bring you some good news and bad news." So I said, "Shoot, what is it?" Well, Fred at that time was the director of the Shelby County Department of the Aid. It was very political. It was before he had COVID. He was running for COVID. So he said, "The good news is you went over and took the test, and you made the high score, but you might have taken it." I said, "Tell me something else. You know me, I'm very arrogant." So he said, "The next thing is I can't recommend you for the job. Because number one, you married to a white man. Number two, you're a Democrat. And my boss, L.C. Martin, is afraid that you might go into the North End and politicize all the black folks that's on public aid and make a Democrat." Well, it hurt me so bad, I really didn't know what to do. So I said, "Well, Fred, thank you. Goodbye." So he left. I called the then county chairman of the Democratic Party, who indeed was serving in Springfield as a legislator. And that was the late Leo Pepper. I know anything about the man. I appeared in several Democratic functions. He knew I was a Democrat. And I asked him for help. I said, "This is a political thing. I want your help." He said, "I can't help you, but I know somebody who can." So he made a long distance call to Carnell Davis. By the way, he did put a check in the mail for me for $50. I don't know what that was for, but this was sympathy. And Carnell Davis called me the next day. And when I told him what happened, he said, "Have no fear, we will beat them. In the meantime," he said, "I can only," speaking of himself, he said, "I can only handle the political aspect. You need to handle the legal aspect." I had was very fortunate having met a white judge down in Tuscola, Illinois, the late Judge Pate. I had seen him at some meetings having to do with not affirmative action, really, I don't know what it had to do with, but we had met. I called him. He gave me the name of a lawyer in Decatur, Illinois, still my best friend, Lloyd Latendre. Lloyd Latendre and Carnell Davis won that case for me. And in spite of the rigid political situation, and I've heard some people in here call some names of people in this room today, I would like to tell the role they played and how I met them at this particular time. But I don't want to change any facades or any impressions that anybody might have of anybody in this room. So I'll just let sleeping dogs lie. But let me say, between Carnell Davis and Lloyd Latendre, we broke the barriers. And when we broke the barriers, they knew those people didn't want me, and I really didn't want them. So we tried to find a face-saving way for me to get out of here so they could have their place, and I could go on and do my thing. Well, let me say that as a result of my breaking out of the segregation, you go in there now, you never know that situation had ever occurred. But we were fortunate enough to find that the Department of Public Aid gave a scholarship. And so I signed some little piece of paper that really wasn't written in ink, and she used to write on it. Signed a contract saying that I worked for them, and they'd send me to school and get my MSW. And I got my MSW, and I told them what they could do. And I went on to work somewhere else, and I still haven't paid. Congress madly brought that up when I ran for Congress, as though people didn't already know it. Well, enough about Carnell Davis, he's still my father. Let me now move into the rest of the arena, and I want to get through this. I dug up the profile of a person I had the pleasure of meeting and having and hearing speak in person. And this is the late Adam Clayton Powell, Jr. Adam Clayton Powell was one of the most flamboyant, dynamic, educated black leaders who has ever made an appearance into the political arena. I had the occasion of meeting him and hearing him speak in 1967 when I attended the National Elks Convention in New York City. And he was the main speaker at our National Oratorical Contest. And this is a memory I hope I'll never forget. He was a pastor of Abyssinian Baptist Church, following the footsteps of his father, who indeed was very political. He was elected to the New York City Council in 1942. He published a weekly newspaper called The People's Voice. In 1945, he was elected to the United States Congress, representing Harlem. He sponsored a tremendous amount of controversial civil rights in legislation. In 1960, he became chairman of the House Committee on Education and Labor, and he just never should have done it. Because that's at that time, the white folks started plotting to get rid of him, and they indeed did. This was a post that allowed him to exercise more power than any Negro had before he did. He was censored and denigrated by his colleagues. He left Congress, managed to get reelected, but in 1970 he retired to the Bahama Islands, where he died 2 years later. Senator Edward Brooke, another very illustrious politician. Now I'm going to talk about a black Republican, I'm going to talk about Democrats. He was born in Washington, D.C., served as an infantry officer in World War II, received his LLB degree from Boston University. In 68, he was the only Republican in the state of Massachusetts, that's white, black, alderman, to be elected to a statewide office. That must be 60. He was elected to the office of Attorney General. Let me say something about this gentlemen. He later went on to be elected the first senator of the United States, black senator since Reconstruction. I wanted so bad to ask my husband for the money to pay for television and radio time and ask every black person in the state of Illinois to refuse to vote for Adlai Stevenson. But I wouldn't do it because I'm still supposed to be a good Democrat. When Adlai Stevenson was senator up there in Washington, D.C., he used his position as chairman of the Ethics Committee to bring in extraneous information about this man's divorce that had nothing whatsoever to do with his tenure as senator. He was running a very close election against a very liberal, popular Democrat, and lost that election. After which, Adlai Stevenson apologized and said he was sorry. Well, we lost our only black senator. I don't care if Adlai Stevenson runs for dog kitchen again. He did not get my vote this last time. He will not get it again. Because I don't believe we're going to elect a black senator to replace Senator Brooke anytime soon. Let me speak collectively about Maynard Jackson and Andy Young, two distinguished black men who served the city of Atlanta, Georgia. Andy Young, having served as our ambassador to the United Nations, distinguished himself in that role, being appointed by Jimmy Carter and being relieved by Jimmy Carter because of the heat that prevailed upon him. He was still a loyal person. He's a beautiful politician. Maynard Jackson couldn't run to succeed himself, so Andy Young is now the illustrious black mayor of Atlanta, Georgia. I had the pleasure of serving in the Democratic National Committee, on the Democratic National Committee from 1974 to 78. And at that time, the illustrious mayor of Detroit, William Coleman, was vice chairman. So we have a beautiful, dynamic, and efficient mayor of Detroit. Coleman. Everybody, Coleman Young, thank you. Everybody knows, thank you, honey, I can't read my own writing. Coleman Young. Glad she corrected it. Hatcher, everybody knows, he broke the ice in North Mason, that's why, by becoming the first mayor of Northern City, and he is still in Gary. We know that the illustrious Mayor Bradley, who is mayor of Los Angeles, California, ran a very impressive election for governor, but didn't quite make it. Shirley Chisholm, let's talk about some women now. The first black woman elected to Congress in 1971. In 1972, she ran for president. I couldn't find my book on how many delegate votes she did receive. Obviously, she didn't win, but she at least went down in the annals of history as being the first black woman to run for president, and she retired in 1976. Now, I do want to talk about another congresswoman, a black congresswoman, and I will say a little bit more about her, and that is the illustrious Barbara Jordan. A lawyer in Houston, Texas, was elected to the Texas State Senate in 1966. She was the first African American to hold this position since 1883, Reconstruction. In 1972, she was elected to the United States Congress, made the keynote speech at the Democratic National Nominating Convention, in which I was in attendance as a delegate in 1976. And that indeed was a memorable occasion. In spite of the fact that presidential candidate John Glenn had spoken, everybody in that room was walking around doing everything they wanted to do until the chairman, Strauss, called the illustrious Barbara Jordan. You couldn't hardly quiet the room down. People remembered this woman because of her brilliant interpretation of the United States Constitution while serving on the Judiciary Committee. She indeed started the trend that led to Richard Milhouse Nixon's vacating the White House in the middle of his term. She is a brilliant person. Now, I must say this for the benefit of some young people that I see here, and some of us who may not know. At the time, Bob Strauss, and I didn't know him on a first name basis, chairman of the Democratic National Committee, picked Barbara Jordan to give a keynote speech. There was a lot of argument between the members of the Black Caucus. Certain members of the Black Caucus didn't like it because Strauss had not conferred with them to get their idea as to who the black person should be. Well, if anybody knew Bob Strauss, you might know what Bob Strauss said when they sent this little dumb committee up away from Strauss. I won't repeat it in church what he said. He just said Barbara Jordan was his choice. And I'm sure that at the time she made the speech, she was America's choice. Because there was actually a movement on the floor to try to get her to run for president. And I'm sure that if her name had been nominated, Jimmy Carter's people would have had done a lot of politics and would have ended up putting her on the ticket as vice president in order for him to get it. Well, I don't want to get into the intricate politics, but that was interesting. I just had to mention. A person who I am privileged to say is a personal friend of mine, C. DeLois Tucker. C. DeLois Tucker was the first and only black woman ever to serve as the secretary of the Commonwealth of the State. state of Pennsylvania, where she served from 1974 to 1978. At the time, and that's when I met her. Before I went to my first meeting of the Democratic National Committee after I was elected the first woman ever to serve on the State Central Committee in the state of Illinois, and to be elected vice chairman of the state party in the state of Illinois, I received a telephone call from this dynamic lady congratulating me on my accomplishment, and I might add telling me how to vote in the upcoming election, where they were going to elect state chairman, the president of the state chairman association. Bob Lance, you know Bob Lance? Bob Lance was running for chairman of the state president. And he was running against Don Bowden, who was from South Carolina, North Carolina. But anyway, Dolores called me up to tell me that the Black Caucus was supporting Bob Lance, and asked me for my support for being a good politician, in spite of the fact that I was the first person to be elected state vice chairman of the state party. I had to confer with the chairman of my party, and on conferring with him, the politics were just not so for us to go along with that ticket. And I was very sorry. I had to apologize to her that I could not vote for her. I had to go along with my chairman, but we still became good friends. And I might add that our friendship extended to the point where, when she was assisting the presiding officer of the Women's Caucus in 1976, part of the Democratic National Convention, and she saw me in the room, she said, "Hey, recognize the lady in the state of Illinois." And I had the opportunity to speak to the nation over the ABC network, articulating some of my opinions about some of the issues that were going on in the Black Caucus. The Women's Caucus. I might add that I lost a lot of white friends here in Champaign Valley, but it really didn't make any difference because I was speaking my convictions, which I will get to just a little bit later. I think that this ends my profile of certain outstanding individuals. Now, to finish this, let me say that it is very difficult to demarcate the political, the social, and the educational lines. And I'm assuming that they cannot be demarcated. So I will close by saying that the ideology of oppression, whether it's in South Africa, whether it's in the Third World, whether it's in Mississippi, Alabama, or Illinois, is always promulgated through the educational arena. And this is particularly true in the United States of America. We have reached the pinnacle today, or we have reached a point in our society where we are no longer involved, as Mrs. Gray said, in racial wars. The wars have now become class wars. The black bourgeoisie, as well as the white bourgeoisie, live in the same neighborhoods, walk to school, their children are not bused. They get the benefit of a class college-bound education. But our poor whites and poor blacks who live on the other side of the tracks have to give up the class war that I remember Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King articulating so well that day, Mildred, the day that they crossed the bridge itself, and he gave his speech. I was there lying on the grass. I just wondered if he wrote it, whether some of the historian wrote it. But in that speech, he talked about the need for the white bourgeoisie to polarize, pit the poor blacks against the poor whites. Well, now, for the poor blacks and poor whites, it's time for us to give up that war. Because there is a war now between not only the bourgeois whites and the bourgeois and the lower class whites, but it is between the bourgeois blacks and the lower class blacks. How are we going to resolve this dilemma? I don't know, but my remedy for it all is to see more black people announce that they are being political. See, all of us are political. I don't know of any other arena where more politics goes on in public schools and in University of Illinois, you know that. But we tend to think of politics as occurring only among Democrats and Republicans. Well, that's a bad misnomer. Let me tell you a little about local politics, and I hope that this will support the hypothesis that I just advanced. The illustrious Harry Tebow, who unfortunately, I understand, is dying of some kind of rare disease. I can remember the time when Harry Tebow led a bunch of black students in Champaign, Urbana to picket black barbers. Black barbers and black beauticians were the only independent black entrepreneurs he had in his town besides preachers. Instead of him organizing those black students to picket the racism at the University of Illinois, he came out here to picket the black barbers. He and I have never been friends since then. Now that's, you want to get into some local politics. Another thing I might say a little bit about local politics is Kenneth Stratton, I think, was he the first black city councilman? Yeah, he ran for city councilman, and Jonathan Johnson, and now Purdue. The participation of black men in politics has been very shallow in this town. And since that's the way it is, I would hope that more black women will join me in what seems to be a hopeless, futile task. But I think it has paid off. Regardless of what the situation is today, I noticed some people say she used to be involved in politics. That's not going to be past tense too long. And for those of you who don't know, let me again reiterate that whether or not I become involved again or not is irrelevant. As Bernadine State told somebody the other day, she said, I wish I was as tough as Animal Scott. I know that I have accomplished something that no white woman in America would ever accomplish because I was first. I'm not cocky about it, but I was the first woman to ever be elected to the Democratic States of America. I want to warn you in my conclusions to be ever aware of the inevitable collision course. And it is inevitable. I'm predicting it. Some of my friends are sweeping it under the rug. But I'm going to predict it. There's going to be a war between white women and the advocates of the civil rights movement. Because white women constitute 53.1% of this population. They are politically astute. They're educated. You know it was Bakke who first started this mess about affirmative action. It was a white woman down in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. This is how I got nationwide TV at the black women's, at the white, not white, black, Democratic caucus, women's caucus in 1976, was because this is what I addressed. For those of you who'd like to see further documentation, look at the Atlantic Monthly in 1976. Now, so let me warn you, Miss, I wish I could be as complacent, as content, as those of us, as some of those who have spoken here. But I'm very anxious, I'm impatient. I guess you be what I heard a member of PIN once say. What is the word he used? Well, anyway, I am. patient Christian and a patient crusader. And I hope the rest of you will join with me and enter this political arena and let's finish this unfinished. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you very much.
Now that's cool, and I'm sorry I didn't do it at the beginning. I want to thank all these ladies. Now we will have a short question period. If you want to ask any of us any questions about anything that we said, anything that we didn't say, I'm sure we left out a whole lot. So you're free now for a few minutes. How many minutes? About 20 minutes of questions. I'll be prepared for a social hour.
Yes, I just did not understand what you know, she said.
All right, the inevitable collision course. If I'm going down a one-way street and I need to go the wrong way, one of us is going to get out of the way. And I am suggesting that that is exactly what is happening. Civil rights and the white feminist movement. These people are using issues that we may be in sympathy with. But on the other hand, they are getting the opportunities. Now, there's nothing wrong with this, because we live in a capitalistic society. As Spencer said, the survival of the fittest. All I'm saying is they are the fittest, and they might out-survive us if we don't get on our toes and tell our kids the way it is. Now, I'm sure, here's a lady out here that's been struggling for years, going back, go ahead, please, ma'am.
What did you mean, Mrs. Scott, about why didn't you picket the barber shop and the...
I was opposed to having Harry Cheever, an articulate, brilliant philosophy professor, chairman of the... Well, he wasn't chairman of the Democratic Party, he was trying to get to be chairman, organized black students to picket black entrepreneurs.
Why did he have to picket them?
Pardon?
What were they doing? Why did he want to picket them?
He wanted them to cut the head. No, I'm sorry, he got me mixed up now. He didn't picket black entrepreneurs, he picked them on white.
Yeah.
He wanted the white barbers to cut black head.
Oh, I see.
And when they did, they messed it up.
And I was saying, if he really wanted an issue, why didn't he fight that discrimination over there at that University of Illinois when you all had enough black students over there to hold prayer meeting? Not quite enough. He didn't have to come out and bomb me on business people.
Now, I want to say this too. The students, the Negro students on the campus had to come to work. There were only about, I'd say, three or four Negro barbers. The students had to come clear across town. Some of them
had the idea that they shouldn't have to come over to the room to pick up a legal barber to get here. This is what that is.
That's what Harris said. But since I was over there, I can't think of
the picture of that. Are there any other questions? Well, it's not really a question, but I did want to make a comment on something that you have said. You were saying that a lot of gains that we have made are being taken back, and
that is ever so true, and I don't think that a majority of us realize that. I think that since so many of us have acquired things that we were told, you know, previously that we could not have, that we're not keeping up with things that affect us directly. We had a hard time with the Voting Rights Act. You know, I don't know why Reagan supported that, but I'm pretty sure he did for the sake of not having too many people on his back. But you know, the Voting Rights Act, when that was an issue, you know. But personally, I can say that after the Bakke decision, before the Bakke decision, in my class at the law school, we had about 14 blacks attending. I think about 20-something were accepted, but only about 14 of us showed up. After the Bakke decision, they had 5 black students over there, and it has been about the same amount since then. And they attribute that to the fact that many blacks were discouraged by the Bakke decision. They didn't even try to apply. But I don't think.
How many white women do you have, though? You got a lot.
Oh, this, yeah, that's a lot. But I'm just saying that, and then you were saying that now we can live any place that we want to, and I don't know if I'm considering that as a general statement, because that's not necessarily so. I mean, you still have fights up in Chicago about these restrictive covenants barring people from, you know, in your deeds is saying that you will not rent to a black person and all, and we're still fighting that. I think now that we have more access to the court system, but it's, you know, the problem's not over. And I think the same thing may be true here in Champaign. I don't know for sure, but I'm just saying that it's not necessarily so that you can live any place that you want to, or you can have any job that you want to, because you're out there competing. And now, you know, before it was like blacks against, you know, whites as far as the job. But now it's more like man against woman. And it's not easy. You know, I've been in the job market for over a year now, and I'm competing with people who are, you know, just as educated as I are, or more educated. And it's very competitive out there, and by no means are they giving up anything without putting something aside for their own. And I think that's the way it's been in the past, and I think it's going to be more so in the future. It seems like every time when times get really hard, they're not so willing to, you know, make room for black people to come in. And I, as far as affirmative action is concerned, I don't think that is as strong as it was, you know, when it was first instituted. And I think that we're losing grounds in that area. So, you know, before they were giving up, and I attest that it was a fight from day one until the day that I got out. And I think that they're still having, you know, problems over there.
There is still a section in Champaign that has an unwritten covenant that blacks don't move into.
Yes, you mean in housing?
Yes.
Yes, and I'm familiar with that section.
What is?
I've pleaded. You go out Main Street or University Avenue, what is that, Stoke? They have a group there, and they have found, I work with a lady that lives there, and she said they have a written covenant that no one there is to ever sell to a Negro. And I said, Carrie, if I find a Negro that has the money to buy a house, I can't remember the section.
Is it adjacent to the Ennis Division?
Right, way off Main Street.
Okay. Yeah. Because he.
It's north and east of Urbana. I said, if I find a client that has the money and they like a house in your section, I don't care what kind of organization you have out here, I will sell them that house, and there's nothing you can do to stop. And I have asked several Negroes, if you have the money to move into Greencroft, move. I think they would be accepted by the majority. It isn't always the upper class that we have to watch. It's this middle class. I always feel, they're the ones that are afraid of us. They are afraid that we will be equal. And I don't want to be equal. I don't want to be just as good. I want to be what I want to be. If I want to live better, eat better, sleep better, I want to do it. I don't want to do it because somebody over there, my friend or somebody across the street is doing it better. I want to do it because I feel like that I want to do it better. Now that's housing. I don't feel that a Negro would be turned down in Greencroft, and if they were, it would be a real good case for Champaign-Urbana. And I don't know why nobody's ever attempted to buy a home in Greencroft. The houses are already
I don't know where it is. That's probably why I don't even know where it is.
Those are our two salvations. Christianity, of course, we're all Christians. We all strive to be better Christians. And I hope, I know everybody here, if we were ladies, we wouldn't come together to learn about one another like we are today. But Christianity is our background. It's our food. Our food, and you have to have food for the soul and food for the mind. So if we grow in Christianity, grow in education, and get involved in politics and grow with what is going on, not in our little yard and our little block, but reach out and find out what other people are going to be concerned.
Well, mine was a comment about the gains and the losses, and I agree with what you said. One of the things that has troubled me recently, I don't know whether most of you heard Roger Wilkins when he spoke at the campus, and then Atlantic Monthly had some statistics that troubled me. The statistics are this, that if we're going to be a strong and a vital force from this time on, we're not only going to have to be involved in politics, certainly we don't vote like we should. Just get our people to just get them out to vote is just something that is most tiresome, because I have worked so tirelessly in that arena. But the second thing, we're going to have to be more involved with our teenagers, and especially our teenage girls. The statistics that I'm speaking of is just a negligent part of what was spoken of here. And yet, I wonder, because we've got to think of our future young people. 60%, he quoted it, and the Atlantic Monthly didn't have it quite that high. It was, and the statistics there were not just black race, it had Hispanic, no. But I'm concerned that 60% of the babies that were born this year and now black children were born illegitimate to those under 25. Can you imagine how staggering are the implications for our future generation? Those kids, most of them, are illegitimate. Most of them, I don't say all of them, are babies themselves, because he went on and quoted statistics under that. So many of them are 15-year-old, 13-year-old. And we, older women, somehow or other, are going to have to stem that tide. Now, that wasn't just for Champaign-Urbana, but we know what it is in Champaign-Urbana. I think it's even higher.
Ms. Donaldson, may I
comment? That worries me. Yes.
May I comment on this, darling?
Yes.
That's your feminists, your very vocal feminists, are doing everything they can to destroy the moral fabric of this society. Now, this is saying, not saying that we have all been angels, because Lord knows the world has not been
angels. No,
but most of us, whatever we didn't go around trying to harness everybody else to do the same thing we were willing to follow us. They are trying to make it a national policy to first of all, you know the implications of, you remember how they used to grab those kids over there in high school and take them down there and give birth control, and parents didn't even know anything about it. And then when the kid did get pregnant, sometimes they were paying for the abortions. Now, and they were all saying, well, this is the right to life. Maybe so with them, but they're taking these kind of things and they're destroying us. You see, we're trying to become so white. We're not separating what's good and what's bad among them.
And you see, nutritionally, Mrs. Scott and others, all of us know it's been documented. It's a documented fact. In fact, that if these young people are babies themselves and having babies, they're not going to get the proper prenatal care, they're not going to get the proper nutrition, and what's going to happen to their minds? Irreversible damage. Irreversible damage. And that's one of the things. That's all the part of what you were speaking about. I just turn it back to you. But I think we should be concerned about it.
Maybe sometime you can talk, come in and expound on that again. Before you go, remember that although Mrs. Humphrey's not here, Mrs. Dorothy Vickershell is here to take your dues if you have not paid them, and your monthly dues that you will have to pay. Before we go, too, we have refreshments back there. We'd like you to partake of that. And please, would we all stand?